Feeling stressed, left without gravity, in an environment that gets more and more complicated and complex every day? Untangle your mind and go back to the roots of clear thinking. Get the original text of The Leviathan by Hobbes, The Two Treatises of Government by Locke, The Social Contract by Rousseau, plus the U.S. Constitution from Pennsylvania, bound together into just one practical book. That's right, Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, and the U.S. Constitution, bound together into just one practical book to keep your costs low.
So in some sense, Freud believed that the things that you repressed were things that you knew and understood, but didn't want to attend to or believe or understand or integrate or develop or even allow to exist. And so the unconscious was reduced to using subterfuge in some sense to get its point across. Now, it's a powerful argument. It's one we're going to return to when we talk about Freud, but I don't think it's right. I think Jung's explanation of symbols is better. I think it's right, although there may be times when Freud's correct, but I think that would be a subset of the times when symbolism is used. Imagine that there are different forms of knowledge, first, because it's important to recognize that before you can really think about something like the use of symbolism, the unconscious, the use of symbolism by the unconscious. I mean, first of all, there's the form of knowledge that everyone knows as knowledge, which is articulated knowledge, right? And so articulated knowledge is often factual, or it can be procedural, because you can tell someone how to do something. But, and everyone thinks of, and then there's knowledge about facts of various forms, which may or may not be true, but that's really irrelevant. That's often the sort of knowledge that you learn, say, in a classroom. Procedural knowledge is a different issue, because you can learn that by doing or by imitating. Even in science, which is a process and a method as well as a body of knowledge, even in science, a lot of the knowledge isn't explicit and articulated. It's actually procedural. This is something Thomas Kuhn talked about, for example, in his famous book on scientific revolutions, because partly when you're a graduate student, for example, or to a lesser degree, an undergraduate, it's more relevant when you actually start practicing science. A lot of the knowledge that you bring to bear on the subject is actually implicit. You can't really explain it. And so some examples of that might be like learning how to look through a microscope, which turns out to be a very difficult thing. You have to practice for many hours before you get good at looking through a microscope. Or maybe if you're a radiologist, you have to read x-rays or fMRIs or that sort of thing. You can build up a body of knowledge that makes you a perceptual expert, but you can't really get that kind of knowledge without practice. You know, it's sort of like learning how to play the piano, say, or learning how to walk, or any complex act of perception or action is seldom fully articulatable. And so that's another kind of knowledge. You might call that embodied knowledge. And there is a memory form that goes along with that, which is procedural memory, right? And a lot of what you know is procedural memory. And then there's another kind of knowledge, which is, I suppose, autobiographical. And that's often referred to as, say, episodic memory. And autobiographical knowledge would be your memory of yourself as an actor in the world. You know, so I suspect for many of you, well, let's find out for how many this is true. When you remember an episode in the past, or when your mind is wandering and episodes of the past come up, how would you describe the form in which they emerge? Are they like, for how many people are they like little movies? Okay, is there anyone for whom that's not true? Yeah, okay, so when you think about the past, or when the past comes to mind, in what form does it come to mind? Stills. Stills, okay, but it's still images.
Yes.
Is there anybody, okay, fine. There's also knowledge about the past that's semantic knowledge, articulated knowledge, and that would be factual knowledge about what you did in the past, but that seems to be a more thoroughly processed form of memory, because in some sense what you've done, if you're extracting out articulated knowledge from past experiences, is that you have to pull out the gist. You reduce it. You know, it's sort of like, imagine that you have a conversation with someone and it lasts 2 hours and someone says, well, what did you talk about? Well, you don't repeat the entire conversation verbatim, right? You do some weird job of compressing the information into something like a summary. And you do that more or less automatically, you know. It's quite a remarkable process, actually, because you get the gist or you get the point, whatever the point is. It's not like it's that easy to extract from a conversation. That's another form of knowledge that you can formulate. But then there's sort of borderline forms of knowledge, you know, and those are the ones that seem to be expressed, as far as I can tell, in something that's more like symbolic representation. So we talked last time a little bit about a parent acting the role of a father. So the parent is embodying whatever father means. And the child's prepared for that because children generally have a father. And, of course, children are prepared to interact with men like they're prepared to interact with women. They understand men and they understand women. And a lot of that knowledge comes like hardwired in. So the child might be observing the father across multiple contexts, trying to understand precisely who this creature is, but then also learning how to embody that insofar as she might be learning how to interact with males or he might be learning how to imitate a male. Of course, there's some of that that's going on with both genders. And then a lot of what's summarized in the acting out, in the pretending, also seems to be like gist, because when a child imitates his father and is pretending to be a father, for example, he isn't just duplicating exactly what he's seen. What he's doing, in some sense, you might think of as extracting out the commonalities of behavior across different contexts that the father manifests in order to get a handle on the spirit of the father. And then it's the spirit of the father, in some sense, that the child's trying to embody. And that would be whatever makes a father different from a man. And so, you know, you can certainly, I'm sure you know perfectly well, when you go home to visit your parents or when you interact with them on a day-to-day basis, when your father is being a father and when he's just being a man. There'd be voice tone and stance and gaze and all sorts of like articulated phrases that you're familiar with that are part of the role of father. And you could see other people's fathers acting like fathers too. Now, it seems to be that a lot of symbolic representation has to do with the extraction of the gist. It's like exactly what is, it's a categorization process. It's exactly what it is that these various behaviors have in common. And what they have, if they're embodied behaviors, what they have in common is something like a spirit. So I think it was Hegel who talked about the spirit of the times. And you know how if you look at photographs that are like 20 years old, all of a sudden they're dated. You know, for a while photographs look like they're current, and then all of a sudden, poof, they're dated. And you think, how in the world did people think they were normal when they were dressed like that? You know, and there are frequently occurrences in culture where there's an emergence of a style that seems consistent across the entire culture, like the Art Deco movement was like that. And what seems to be the case in those situations is that there are novel ideas being generated, but everyone is imitating everyone else as rapidly as they possibly can because they're communicating in an articulated way and they're copying each other. And out of that, you get something like a spirit or ethos of the time. And so a lot of what symbolism is trying to do is to extract out commonalities across contexts, and often commonalities that you really don't understand. Like they're categories, they're almost like pre-categories. Or they're levels of representation that are trying to represent something that's actually too complex for you to articulate. So for example, many of you will act out being a mother or being a father when you have children, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you could fully articulate the knowledge that you have about what it is to be a mother or a father. And so you have the knowledge because you can act it out, and it's somewhat, you have some form of representation of the knowledge too, because you can understand it when it happens, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you can fully articulate it. So you could say, for example, that you have an image of what a mother is, and the image wouldn't be just a still, it would be maybe a sequence of stills or something like that, but it's more like a pattern of behavior, your image of the pattern of behavior that characterizes a given role. And so that's a good way to think about symbols, I think, and that was sort of the Jungian way of thinking about them. Jung believed that a symbol was nature's attempt, nature within you, say, nature's attempt to express a relatively unknown idea in the clearest possible manner, even though that wasn't necessarily clear. And, well, we use symbols all the time for that sort of purpose. You see them all the time when you go to movies, for example. movies are full of symbolism. I was just interpreting the dream of one of my clients the other day, and he dreamt that he was following a spirit around in the basement of a house that was like a maze, and the spirit kept disappearing and reappearing, and he gathered some people around him that was sort of like a, I would say a social network, because he's been working on developing a social network. And as that social network got developed, he felt more and more confident to search out this spirit and to chase it around the basement. Finally, the spirit manifested itself, a ghost. It was a blue ghost, ghostly thing. It came out of a box that was in one of the basement rooms that had a toilet seat on it. So it was like a toilet that was on a, it was like a toilet that was on a box, which is just what I said. And then the spirit disappeared down into the toilet, and he looked in there along with some other people, and there was a huge, massive, maze-like structure of many, many rooms underneath. And I thought, well, that's actually quite a common representation in dreams, but does that remind anyone of anything? Anything that's not unbelievably pathological? It's like the story in the second part of Harry Potter. Right? Do you remember that? So you have Moaning Myrtle. She inhabits the bathroom. She's always diving into toilets. And don't they find the understructure of Hogwarts by going through that bathroom into the subterranean elements? Yeah. So that's a good. That realm of symbolism is something like underneath. This is exactly what the case is with the second Harry Potter story. Is that underneath the edifice of culture, and that would be Hogwarts in that particular story, there's a subterranean realm, and in that subterranean realm lurk things that can paralyze you if you look at them. That's the basilisk. Now what do you think happens if a rabbit sees a fox? What does it do?
Freezes.
It freezes. Why?
So it can't be seen?
Absolutely, right. The rabbit assumes that it's camouflaged. And so as long as it doesn't move, then maybe there's some chance that the predator won't see it. And so the idea that you turn to stone when you look at something that's predatory and reptilian, I mean, that's an old idea. You know, God only knows how old that is. It's probably about as old as mammals. I suspect it's something in the neighborhood of 60 million years old, maybe even older than that, because it was at that point that our primitive ancestors were living in trees and being preyed upon by snakes, mostly, because our ancestors back 60 million years ago got eaten by snakes quite a lot. They seem to have co-evolved with us. In fact, there's some evidence from a woman named Lynn Isbell, who's quite an interesting scholar, that the reason that we can see so well is actually because we developed our vision to detect predatory reptiles, most particularly snakes. And the way she found that out was by, because human beings have amazing eyes, eh? We can see like no other animal except for raptors, except for birds of prey. They can see better than us. But as far as primates go, man, we knock it out of the park. And mammals too. We've got amazing vision. And what Isbell did was look around the world to see what predicted how accurate the eyesight of primates were in different locales. And what she found was there's a powerful relationship with the presence of predatory snakes. That's an extraordinarily cool thing. And, you know, it gives you some insight into the level of depth that might be involved in the analysis of the symbolic realm.
Feeling stressed, left without gravity, in an environment that gets more and more complicated and complex every day? Untangle your mind and go back to the roots of clear thinking. Get the original text of The Leviathan by Hobbes, The Two Treatises of Government by Locke, The Social Contract by Rousseau, plus the U.S. Constitution from Pennsylvania, bound together into just one practical book. That's right, Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, and the U.S. Constitution, bound together into just one practical book to keep your costs low.